Brother Tyler Young, when he began his lesson at the beginning of this lectureship, referred to some comments or a statement made by President Roosevelt concerning December 7th of the year 1941. He referred to that date as a day that will live in infamy. He also alluded to the date of September, or rather November 11th, 2001, another day that will now live in our memory. Ever since the attack of 2001 on the United States of America, we have been involved in what is known as a war on terror. And so many are again asking questions about the morality of such. Questions are being asked about carnal warfare and about capital punishment as a corollary to that. The word war can be used to refer to any hostility, contention, struggle, or conflict, whether it be physical or spiritual. But more specifically, it can be used in the physical sense to refer to armed hostility, contention, struggle, or conflict. We want to examine the subject of war this afternoon, and as we do so, we'll talk about the want of war, the warrant for war, and then we'll look at some words of war. In the Old Testament, we often read about war. We read about people, and we'll not cite all of the passages. You can check these in the concordance, but you'll find these phrases. You read about people having war. You'll read about people learning war. You'll read about those making war. You'll read about those preparing war. Others seeing war. And even some teaching war. We are told in Exodus 15 and verse 3 that the Lord is a man of war. Again, in Exodus 17, verse 16, the Lord will have war. 1 Chronicles 5, verse 22, war is of God. And the psalmist said in Psalm 144 and verse 1 that the Lord teacheth war. Isaiah paints a picture of the Lord going forth like a man of war in Isaiah 42 and verse 13. In the New Testament, we read again of making war. We read about men of war. We read about warring after the flesh. Peter talks about warring against the soul. Paul tells Timothy to war a good warfare. When we talk about the want of war, recognize that the word want can be used to refer to a wish or a desire. But no person who truly loves peace wishes for or desires war. But the word want can also be used to refer to a need or a necessity. And sometimes war is necessary. Thus the wise man Solomon, Ecclesiastes 3, would talk about a time of peace and a time of war. When we talk about the want of war, we simply want to recognize that sometimes war is a need, a necessity. When we talk about the warrant for war, the word warrant means, according to Webster, authorization or sanction, as by a superior or the law, justification or reasonable grounds for some act, course, statement, or belief. Such a warrant for war is given to us in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 to 7. Would you read with me from that passage of Scripture? That's Romans 13, verses 1 to 7. The Apostle Paul says, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. For he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Wherefore ye must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor." Now, as we examine that warrant for war, we want to do so by looking at some of the words of war. And as we look specifically at the words of Romans 13, verses 1 to 7, we want to look at the words that have to do, number 1, with the powers, number 2, the purpose, number 3, the people, number 4, the points that the writer makes, and then finally and fifthly, the proof that these things are so. First, the higher powers are discussed concerning their origin, their order, their ordination, and their occupant. Paul actually begins by giving this order. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers. Now, there is a parallel but shorter passage to Romans 13 found in 1 Peter 2, beginning in verse 13. There, the Apostle Peter similarly says, "Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake." That's the order. Secondly, Paul then speaks of the origin of these higher powers. Romans 13, 1 again. There is no power but of God. You might also recall that when Jesus was talking with Pilate, just before Pilate sentenced Christ to crucifixion, in John 19, 11, he said, "Thou couldest have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above." Next, Paul tells us that these higher powers are ordained. He says that the powers that be are ordained of God. And then finally, Paul says that those who occupy these positions of high powers are rulers, according to verse 3 of Romans 13. And the parallel passage in 1 Peter 2, verses 13 and 14 tell us that they may be kings or governors. Secondly, notice the words that concern the purpose of these higher powers. Paul discusses that concerning their works and their weapon. The work of these higher powers is twofold: praise and punishment. Paul says concerning their work of praise, reading Romans 13:3, rulers, this is the negative form of it, rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Then he says, do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. There's the positive aspect of it. He then explained further. He is the minister of God to thee for good. In the parallel passage, Peter says, 1 Peter 2 and verse 14, that these higher powers were sent for the praise of them that do well. Thus, there is a work of praise. Concerning their work of punishment, Paul says, rulers are a terror to the evil, Romans 13:3. He further admonishes in verse 4, if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. There is a work of punishment. And finally, Paul identifies the weapon authorized by God for use by these higher powers in their work of punishing evil. Verse 4, he beareth not the sword in vain. That is their purpose. Thirdly, notice the words concerning the people to whom these things apply. Look at the who, the what, and the why. The who, that is, to whom do these things apply? Paul said, Romans 13:1, every soul. Verse 2, whosoever. Verse 3, those who do that which is good. Verse 4, those who do that which is evil. Peter would simply say in 1 Peter 2:13, yourselves. That's the who. In other words, these things are of universal application. The what tells us that the obligations are those of subjection or submission and support. Concerning the idea of subjection and submission, Paul said in Romans 13:1, let every soul be subject to the higher powers. Peter says, 1 Peter 2:13, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. Paul even adds, coming back to Romans 13 and looking at verse 5, wherefore ye must needs be subject. But there's also the concept of support. Concerning that, Paul speaks, saying, or talking about, the reason for this support and the rendering of this support. The reason, verse 6, is, for this cause pay ye tribute also. He said they are God's ministers. He said that they attend continually upon this very thing. That's why they need support. The rendering of this support is then discussed in verse 7. Render therefore to all their dues. Tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. That's the what. Why? Well, both Peter and Paul give three reasons. One is for the Lord's sake, the second is for wrath's sake, and the third is for conscience's sake. First of all, Peter says, 1 Peter 2:13, that it is for the Lord's sake. You're to do this because the Lord demands it. Paul points out, as we said earlier, there is no power but of God, and these powers that be are ordained of God. Why do we render our submission and subjection? Why do we render our support? They're ordained of God. Secondly, Paul says it's also to be done for wrath's sake. He explains, whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. And he said, they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. You do not want God's wrath descending upon you because you do not submit or place yourself into subjection or support these powers ordained of God. Finally, he will then ask, wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? That's when he said, if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. And he again emphasizes, he's the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. It's to be done for wrath's sake. Thirdly, Paul said it's for conscience' sake in verse 5. The only way that you can have a good or clear conscience is to do what God directs. Number 4, from these words we learn these 13 points. Number 1, the powers, these higher powers, are ordained of God. Number 2, they are sent by God. Number 3, they derive their power from or of God, or as Jesus would say, from above. Number 4, these higher powers are ministers of God to thee. Number 5, they are not a terror to good works. Number 6, they are sent by God for the praise of them that do well. Number 7, they are ministers of God to thee for good. Number 8, they are a terror to the evil. Number 9, they are sent by God for the punishment of evildoers. Number 10, they are revengers of God. Thus, number 11, they are authorized to bear the sword. That means, number 12, they are authorized to execute wrath upon them that do evil. Number 13, Paul said they are God's ministers attending continually upon this very thing. This is what we would call a 24/7 operation. Now, these higher powers, the rulers, the kings, the governors, ordained of God, who are sent by God, who derive their powers of God or from above, who are ministers of God to thee for good, who are not a terror to good works, who are sent by God for the praise of them that do well, and who are also God's revengers, who are also a terror to the evil, who are sent by God for the punishment of evildoers, are authorized by God to bear arms, to use physical force up to and including the taking of human life, if necessary, in order to execute wrath upon those that do evil. And we've already seen these points apply to law enforcement officials in our cities, our counties, our states, our federal agencies, and such like. In other words, this is authorization for our city police, for our county sheriff, for our state patrol, for our FBI. These points also apply with equal force to our nation's armed forces, Air Force, Army, Coast Guard, Marines, Navy, in alphabetical order. All of these are authorized by God to bear arms, the sword, to use physical force up to and including the taking of human life, if necessary, in order to execute wrath upon them that do evil. Now, we said, finally, we would prove that, really, Romans 13 is proof in itself. The very fact that God said it should settle the matter. But let's ask and answer in the 16 or 17 minutes we have left 10 questions real quickly. Number one, does the law of Christ demand that all city, county, state, and federal law enforcement agencies immediately disband? So that there would be absolutely no government resistance to the criminal element in our nation. The correct answer to that question is no. For we have seen that these agencies are ordained of God, Romans 13:1. They are sent by God, 1 Peter 2:13. They derive their power of God, Romans 13:1. They're from above, John 19:11. They are ministers of God, Romans 13:4. Questions 2 and 3. If the answer to the first question is no, and we answered it no, could non-Christians serve in such agencies without sin? Question 3, if the answer to the first question is no, and it was, could Christians serve in these agencies without sin? Well, the correct answer to questions 2 and 3 would be yes. Both non-Christians and Christians are authorized to serve in these agencies. This is true because all men, that is, non-Christians and Christians, are amenable to the law of Christ, of which Romans 13, verses 1 to 7 is a part. Let's demonstrate that by observing that all men who violate the law of Christ are men who are amenable or subject to the law of Christ. If you're not amenable to a law, if you're not subject to it, you can't violate it. So when we find those who are in violation of Christ's law, we know they're subject to Christ's law. Paul would say this, Romans 3:19, we know that what things soever the law saith, it saith to them who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped, and all the world may become guilty before God. And then he added in Romans 4, verse 15, where no law is, there is no transgression. Generally speaking, most pacifists will argue that Christians violate this passage in Romans 13, verses 1 to 7, if and when they bear the sword and use physical force up to and including the taking of human life, if necessary, in order to execute wrath upon them that do evil. Yet that said violation implies that the Christian is amenable or subject to that very passage. They're going to accuse the Christian of violating the passage. They have to admit that the Christian is subject to the passage. But not just Christians are subject to that passage. Whatever this passage teaches in Romans 13, 1 to 7, it teaches or authorizes concerning the non-Christian and the Christian. There's a law of logic, a rule of reasoning known as the law of identity. And for propositions that law states that if a proposition is true, then it is true for all persons in all places at all times. Generally speaking, most pacifists teach that this passage in Romans 13, 1-7 teaches or authorizes the non-Christian to bear the sword and use physical force, even up to and including the taking of human life if necessary, in order to execute wrath upon them that do evil. But if and when they grant that for the non-Christian, it must also be granted for the Christian. So yes, both Christian and non-Christian could serve in these capacities. Question number four. Does the law of Christ demand that the United States immediately disband all of its military armed forces, that is, Air Force, Army, Coast Guard, Marines, Navy, so that there would be absolutely no government resistance to attacks from without, such as occurred on December 7, 1941, and November 11, 2001? Well, the correct answer to that question is no. These forces are also God's ministers attending continually upon this very thing, according to Romans 13, 6. Question 5 and 6. If the answer to the preceding question, that is number 4, is no, and we answered it no, could non-Christians serve in these military armed forces without sin? And question 6, if the answer to the question 4 is no, and it was, could Christians serve in such military armed forces without sin? Well, the correct answer to questions 5 and 6 is yes. And for the same reasons as already given concerning the second and third questions. But let's go a step further. It's also true because all men, that is, non-Christians and Christians, are amenable to the law of Christ, again, of which Romans 13, 1-7 is a part. Let's demonstrate it another way. All laws which are addressed to all men are laws to which all men are amenable. We've already seen that from Romans 3, 19 and Romans 4, 15. But the law of Christ, and Romans 13, verses 1-7, is simply a part of the law of Christ, is a law which is addressed to all men. Look at Matthew 28, 19 and 20. Go ye therefore and teach all nations. Or Mark 16, 15 and 16. Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel, this very law, including Romans 13, 1-7, to every creature under heaven. But more specifically, this passage in Romans 13, 1-7 is addressed to all men. Remember the words, every soul, whosoever, those that do that which is good, those that do that which is evil. The very passage is addressed to all men. Further, whatever this passage teaches or authorizes, for the non-Christian, it also teaches and or authorizes for the Christian. There is another law of logic or rule of reasoning known as the law of contradiction. That law for proposition says that no proposition can be both true and false in the same respects. Generally speaking, most pacifists argue that the same thing, that is, the bearing of the sword, the using of physical force up to and including the taking of human life, if necessary, in order to execute wrath upon them that do evil, they say it's true, or they say it's authorized for the non-Christian, and then they'll turn around and say it's not true, it's not authorized for the Christian. That very reasoning violates the law of contradiction. It is a contradiction. Question 7. If you learned of a plot on your life, would it be a violation of the law of Christ for you to call the law enforcement agencies, whether it be city police, county sheriff, state patrol, FBI, etc., and or, if you were in the military, any of the military armed forces, Air Force, Army, Coast Guard, Marines, Navy, of our civil government under which you live, the old, good old USA, could you call on them to protect you, knowing that those agencies and forces might very well kill, if necessary, the plotters who are attempting to kill you? The correct answer to that question is no. It's not a sin to do that. And that answer is demonstrated to be the correct answer by the Apostle Paul, who did this very thing in Acts 23, verses 12 to 33. More than 40 men plotted to kill Paul. They vowed they would not eat until they had done so. Paul learned of this. He called upon the Roman military armed forces under which he lived to protect him. And those Roman military forces numbered 472 armed soldiers, horsemen, and spearmen. They kept Paul safe, all the while Paul knowing that those Roman military armed forces might very well kill, if necessary, the plotters who were attempting to kill him. They escorted him safely to Caesarea. Paul did not sin. Question number 8. If your answer to question 7 was no, and it was, should have been if it wasn't, would those serving in such agencies and or forces, that is, whether they were non-Christian or Christians, would they violate the law of Christ in answering your call for protection? Well, the correct answer to that question is no. They would violate no law of Christ. The fact that both non-Christians and Christians could serve in such forces, first of all, is seen by observing that all laws which bring blessings to all men who obey them are laws to which all men are amenable. What did the Lord say in Matthew 7, 21? Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father, which is in heaven. James 1, 25, whoso looketh into the perfect law of liberty and continueth therein, he being not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this man shall be blessed in his deed. This passage in Romans 13, 1 to 7. Promises blessings to those that obey, regardless of whether they're Christian or non-Christian. Verse 3, do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. Verse 4, he is a minister or the minister of God to thee for good. They're sent by God for the praise of them that do well. 1 Peter 2:14, Christian or non-Christian. Furthermore, all laws which bring damnation to all men who disobey them are laws to which all men are amenable. Go back to Matthew 7. We read verse 21 a moment ago. Then read verses 22 and 23. Or read John 12 and verse 48, where the Lord says, he that rejecteth me and receiveth not my words hath one which shall judge him, the word which I have spoken, the same shall judge him in the last day. The passage in Romans 13, 1 to 7 warns of damnation to all men, whether they're Christian or non-Christian, if they disobey. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Verse 1. Verse 3, rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Verse 4, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Question 9, can a Christian, without violating the law of Christ, call upon those in law enforcement agencies and or military armed forces to do what he himself could not do without violating the law of Christ if he, that is the Christian, were a member of such agencies or forces? The correct answer to that question is no. And this is shown to be true by observing the fact that the Jews, who did not actually crucify Christ, that is in the physical sense, were just as guilty of sin in the matter concerning his crucifixion as were the Romans who did physically crucify him. Peter made that clear in Acts 2, 22 and 3, when he said, "Ye men of Israel, hear these words, Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved of God among you by miracles and wonders and signs, which God did by him in the midst of you, as ye yourselves also know, him being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, ye have taken, and by wicked hands have crucified and slain." Jews were just as guilty as the Romans, even though they took Christ to the Romans to have him crucified. Last question, number 10. Is all taking of human life, in other words, is all killing, a violation of the law of Christ? In other words, is all killing murder? And the correct answer to that question is no. This answer is seen to be true by observing that the same law of Christ, which authorizes the lawful taking of human life, that is killing, by those who bear the sword and use physical force up to and including the taking of human life if necessary, in order to execute wrath on them that do evil, also condemns the unlawful taking of human life, that is murder, in the same passage. Look at Romans 13:4. If thou do that which is evil, be afraid. He beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. But now look at verse 9. Thou shalt not kill. King James Version. I believe the American Standard Version says murder. Not all killing is murder. Not all taking of human life is unauthorized. Now, what we've seen is that war and Christians engaging in war is approved by God when keeping in line with the law of Christ as set forth in Romans 13, verses 1 to 7, and related passages such as in 1 Timothy, or rather 1 Peter 2. While peace is always preferable, sometimes war is necessary. May we thus pray for peace. May we always be in subjection to and submit to and then support those that bear the sword and use physical force up to and including the taking of human life if necessary in order to execute wrath upon them that do evil. And may God bless those who protect us and serve in the law enforcement agencies and in the military armed forces of the United States of America.